they had 100 wasps, 20 Jews, 4 women, and 1 black person. It was just like...
the formula.
It was standard, you know. It was so obvious. And all that, even though they claimed it.
Penn was so different from Temple.
Yes, right. Right.
There's a question here on politics. And, wouldn't think much doesn't pertain to you. The war perhaps did. Talks about depression. Well,
I was a child.
A child of it, right. And prohibition was not a factor.
No. I do. I guess we had blue laws in
Pennsylvania.
Right. I remember going to a restaurant on a Sunday with my father and some friends, and they got something in a teacup. It's shot of rye. I said, "What is that?" He said, "Tea." I said, "That doesn't look like tea." I was just.
Did Joe send you? Was that the speakeasy? No, that wasn't. I mean, it was the time, but that wasn't in a restaurant. You wouldn't be.
Now, this was, if they knew you, and if you said something, I don't know what the code was, you'd get a teacup for about an ounce and a half of amber fluid.
So you served in the. Did you serve in World War II?
No, I had a knee injury from playing football, and so I was deferred. And I was called up in the doctor's draft.
You were called up?
In the doctor's draft. They had a separate draft.
Oh, I see.
And I was called up in 57. Different physical standards for physicians and infantry.
But that was not World War II.
No, no. This the war's over.
Yeah,
but I turned 18.
No.
Korean War had ended. The Korean War was like 19. I turned 18, the war was still on or coming slowly to a halt. The draft was still on. And I was called up to draft board, but my knee was quite swollen. So.
I'm just trying to figure out what war you were.
Well, I was a civilian.
You were a civilian.
Yeah. The Vietnam War occurred after I did my military service. Well, I processed some GIs for Vietnam. It was some clandestine missions that I remember getting them for shots and stuff like that. We had some things going on well before 1960.
Did the birth of the State of Israel have any influence or impact on you?
Yes, I was a great sense of source of pride to me. That it was a divine nation and to show that they would fight for their security and their identity. I think it made a difference in my mind and vision myself.
There are questions about courtship and marriage.
Okay.
You want to tell us about where you met your wife?
Yeah.
Are we talking about your first wife?
My first wife was, she was a cousin of one of my old friends from high school. She went to college at a small girls' school near Muhlenberg, Iowa, so they asked me to look her up. And I did, and we married and had a son. And then we separated just about time went there. And then we divorced.
Do you have the dates of your marriage?
We were married in 1949 and divorced in about 1959. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was finishing my training.
And then you met your.
Yes, my wife Roberta moved into the same apartment house I lived in, Philadelphia. Across the hall from me, her parents' other, take the trash out to the incinerator. And we were married in 62.
It's in your ring.
I have the same problem.
63. Yeah, 60. We were married in 63. And,
then just run through the dates of your children's birth.
Okay, yeah. My son, Joshua, is 1965. My son, Sandra, was born in 1951. And my daughter, Sarah, was born in 1967.
Sarah with an H? Or
no, Sandra.
Without.
Do you think there's a difference in the way you raised your children from the way you were raised?
I spent more time with my children. My two younger children, I missed my big boys growing up to a considerable extent. But I spent more time with my children, and I had a lot more fun with my father.
Did your father work long hours?
Yeah, right. And life was easier for me than it was for him.
You say he was a merchant. What did he...
It's in the furniture business.
Furniture business.
What is your opinion on the changing mores and permissiveness of our society?
I'm not sure that permissiveness is the important axis, dimension.
I'm not sure I heard what you said.
I'm not sure that that's the most important issue, whether we're permissive about our kids or not. I mean, that's something parents look at, but I think materialism, commercialism, the thing that troubles children and parents is not whether they're too easy with their kids, although I think they tend to be, but I think the most important fundamental thing is that people are too wrapped up in buying and selling and getting and they're missing the real important things in life, like human contact and understanding. And I think the kids feel that. I think that that's what upsets them. A lot of parents give their children lots of stuff, but don't give them guidance or boundaries or sense that they're worth it. I practice pediatrics in an affluent suburb, and a lot of my practice, a lot of the mothers brought their kids to me because they were troubled because their kids were troubled. That's why I went into psychiatry. But I don't think it was just that they were too easy on them, etc. Although I do think that kids need to have firm boundaries. My kids got it, and they joke about it, but they really value it. I think that they have to know that there's more to life than just being rich or having it. There's an awful lot of materialism put in our society.
Were you active in any kinds of parenting? I don't mean as a parent, but in your profession.
Well, I did that stuff. First of all, as a pediatrician, I used to spend a lot of time talking. And when I was in the Army, I used to have classes for pregnant women and their husbands. I instituted a discussion about childbearing and stuff like that.
What's your outlook today? Well, for society.
Well, I'm really troubled. I really think that I think we have the tools to make this life very pleasant and very secure for everybody. But we seem to be giving it up, just like we seem to forfeited the chance to wipe lead poisoning out, which is a trivial thing, but to me it was just an example of that we could control our destiny. And we had the opportunity, and we threw it away, mainly for commercial reasons. And I think, I look at our society right now, the murder rate in Pittsburgh is going down, but the gang murder rate is rising. There's an extraordinary amount of ready violence. I look at our culture, the violence in the media that you see on television, and the mindlessness of some of the television shows. I look at the fact that we're trying to balance the budget on the backs of the poor. 90% of the wealth is up at the top of the pyramid, but we're taking away small amounts of people who can afford a feast. That's crazy. And then we're going to pay for it. And I wonder why we're so blind. You know, that's what really troubles me. And also care. I mean, the fact that people could allow this to happen, and I said, wait a minute, it's disturbing, and it also worries me that we're going to end up with a more hard-hearted, fractionated society.
Do you think racism has gotten worse?
I think it's, well, you know, we don't have lynching anymore, and we did in the 30s and into the 40s. But there is polarization again among the races. There was a moment in the 60s and 70s where some of these bridges were, in fact, being built. But I think that's pulling apart now. I think the blacks feel terribly frustrated, and as a result, there's a lot of anger. And the whites feel frightened, and there's a lot of anger. And so that's why we hear those yelling about capital punishment. Terribly expensive, ineffective, and cruel way to do things. And people don't listen to each other. I mean, the opportunity to listen is shrinking. If you look at the O.J. Simpson thing, it's another example. Look at the Gamage case. People just have two separate sides. So that's very troubling. Particularly since we have, we don't have to worry about Russia. You know, we don't have to spend $300 billion a year on arms. We could do all these things, and we're not doing it. And the quality of a political discourse is dreadful. And I don't see any signs that it's going to get better. That people are willing to talk about the real issues. There are very few politicians who are really willing to talk about the real issues. Very few. So that's, yeah, I'm a little dim about it right now.
You want to end this segment? It's almost 1 o'clock, and that's why I was...
It's almost 2 o'clock.
It's 10 to 2.
10 to 2.
How much did the time
you have? I have 5 minutes left.
Okay.
Sure.
How do you view your successes and accomplishments?
Well, my most important one is that I have wonderful children and a wonderful wife. It's a source of great gratification. We have a lot of fun, a lot of laughter when we see each other. My work is a source of pride to me. I see that spelled out in changes in society that are good for people. But I am extremely frustrated and dismayed that we didn't capitalize on wiping this disease out in the 1950s. A Russian physician went to the World Health Organization and said, we've wiped out smallpox in Russia, and we can do it in the world. And the Secretary General of the WHO
dismissed him. And then somebody South American medical organization came to the Secretary General and said the same thing. And then there was some pressure from the U.S. and he felt under pressure, so he said, well, the United States is making all this noise. We'll let them take the lead, and then when it fails, they'll also take the blame for it. We'll shift the blame from me. So that's what happened. The CDC undertook the smallpox prevention and we wiped it out. So it can happen. That's what I told Dr. Mason when I was in his office. And he agreed, and we had that moment when we were like, he said it was a $30 billion package where we would find a way to raise the money and do it. And I was very excited. And I was like, dream come true. You're part of that.
Well, what do you think would be needed to wipe out lead poisoning?
Well, now it's very simple. It's a matter of taking it out of houses, period. And, I mean, that's 95% of it. And what we have to do is it's purely...
It's not like, yeah.
What you have to do is you have to spend the money on taking it out of houses.
Why?
It's an enormous employment opportunity.
What would be involved in taking it out of the house?
How do you do it?
Yeah.
With scrapers and sanders and
maybe
some. Yeah.
And how far back would a house be that would still have lead paint in it?
Well, there's still houses built in 1970. Yeah,
even in 1970?
Yeah, sure. But the bulk of them are houses built before 1960. We're talking about a $30, $40 billion package. But the number of jobs that would be created and the amount of money saved would be in the 60 or 70 billions. So that's personally, that it's, as I'm coming to the end of my career, it's research, but I'm not going to start any major new efforts right at this moment. I see that it's not going to happen. I really thought it was 5 years ago. I was the founding chairman of the Alliance Against Childhood Lead Poisoning, which is a Washington-based public interest group. And we had a lot of clout. Then they just kind of became, just like other major Washington operatives, they just didn't raise any money and publishing stuff. So I resigned. So that's a disappointment. But you have to be a realist. You don't do what you wish. Do you?
Not necessarily. What brought you to Pittsburgh? Who's it?
Well, Dr. Detry told me the streets were paved with gold. I could have anything I want. So I left hard.
Well, if you were a melon or a frickin' list.
Yeah, that's
you
know. Right. Okay.
So you left Harvard.
Yeah.
And is this as prestigious for you because it was at Harvard?
Well, it doesn't have quite the patina that Harvard Medical School does. You have a very fine group of people. They're not here today. They're all on vacation. A very fine group of people.
I guess that's why it was so quiet here on vacation.
Yeah, right. There's only one I'm just getting back. That's just around.
Contrast Pittsburgh with Philadelphia.
Pittsburgh is a nicer, friendlier place. It suffers from a lack of ideas. We can do something. I think the government is tired. And I think the new ideas don't find soil. They still act as though the robber barons are alive, you know? But the bricks before you do anything. There's just that kind of mentality. And you don't see very much good creativity and friction. And I went in Boston, and it was all the time. New things. People coming up with new attempts to do things. More than Boston and Philadelphia, although I think there's some of that in Philadelphia.
Are you in favor of all the stadiums and...
No, I think that's utter foolishness. Building stadiums and jails. Utter waste. That these people can come in and try to demand it from the city and so many other places to spend the money. The outreach.
How do you feel about the city helping businesses to...
Well, I think that has to be done.
Nordstrom's and...
Yeah, that's fine. Nordstrom's. Well, I think this city has to reindustrialize. I think that's the country too.
Reindustrialized.
Yes, right. What made this city great was industry, not service jobs. Service jobs, they don't make it. They don't add value. You got too many advertising agencies and stuff like that. And the fact that the university is the major employer, that's a very serious thing. Because the university may make some new knowledge, but it doesn't make much. And that's basically what's problem with our cities. There used to be factories in the cities where people could get out of high school and make a living.
Now it's a global economy.
Well, that's a very serious problem. All the jobs for people who don't have a college degree are in Thailand or Burma. And there's a book out I haven't read yet by William Grider. He's a very fine political writer. Another book, on this very issue of the globalization and how it is really eating away at our substance. And I don't know if you read about the Maquila women in Mexico, what it's doing down in Mexico. Well, there's mass murders down there. These young women who are employed in the electronics industry, 17, 18-year-old girls, some of them disappearing, etc. Sold into prostitution because it's breaking up the culture of the Mexican family. So it's damaging both societies. There's an article in the Nation magazine recently. All right, so what are we going to do?
We're going to debrief.
Okay.
And I'd like to keep the door open for us to come back.
Right.
And we'll set up another appointment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Costello.
Great.
I didn't want to...